MS in electrical engineering, and a PhD, so it's Dr. Radin, in psychology, both from the University of Illinois. For 10 years, he conducted research on advanced telecommunication systems at AT&T Bell Labs and GTE Laboratories. Then, for the majority of the last 20 years, he has investigated psychic phenomena in academic and industrial positions. Dean served as a member of a classified research project investigating psychic phenomena for the U.S. government at SRI International, headed PSI research programs in Silicon Valley for two scientific and industrial think tanks, has been senior scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences since 2001, and is also adjunct faculty at Sonoma State University in California. Dean's research has been featured in numerous magazines, and he's appeared on several radio and television programs. In addition, he is author of the book, The Conscious Universe. Now, for those of you who would like something really creepy to do tonight as you listen to the program, I'll probably get in trouble for this, but go to Google and put in Princeton eggs, like Princeton University, that's what it is, and then eggs, Princeton eggs. And if you can get to the actual website of the eggs themselves, and you don't think it's creepy, we're going to explain to you in a few moments exactly what it is you're seeing and hearing when you view the Princeton eggs on your computer. But it is a totally creepy, creepy experience. It creeps me out every time I do it, but I love it. So go ahead, go to Google and put in Princeton eggs, and then it'll kind of set the mood because you're going to hear it all explained here in a very few moments with Dean Radin. In all the years that I've been doing talk radio and this kind of talk radio, I've never found anything that I've been more interested, fascinated with, and in fact sure of, than I have this whole consciousness thing. Dean Radin, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Art. It's good to hear you.
And you as well. Now, I just finished sending a whole bunch of people up to the eggs. They're kind of fun, kind of interesting. I mean, it's, I don't know, perhaps somewhat meaningless to just sit and watch them, but there's some sort of intriguing creepiness to it all. And they're going to be sitting there watching those and listening to that heartbeat-like sound with the dings and gongs every now and then. And they're going to be wondering what it is they're seeing, because they're new to all this and have no idea what we're talking about.
Actually, I'm interested in why you're referring to them as creepy.
I don't know. There's a... Because to me they are kind of creepy, not in a horror movie creepy kind of sense. Just, I don't know, sitting there looking at perhaps understand. I think understanding what I'm looking at and hearing is a little bit creepy. I mean, you know, that may be consciousness we're observing at work in its random and sometimes not so random way. So I. Yeah, creepy in that sense, that's all. The magnitude of it, I think, Dean.
Right. So I assume you're talking about the little dot that will change color and the sounds go along with it.
That's right.
What that's showing is a close to real-time representation of the degree of order in a worldwide network of random number generators.
In other words, each one of those little... Well, when I see it, I see bars. I guess it depends on how you have it set, but I see some bars that go up and down and the sounds and everything. And each one of those separate bars represents a computer someplace or another in the world, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and these computers are generating as close to a random number as can be generated. Is that correct?
Each device is fundamentally random. At least as far as we know through quantum mechanics, there is no known way of predicting what each successive random bit will be.
Right.
So it's theoretically and fundamentally random.
Okay.
The exciting thing is, and perhaps the creepy thing is, that at times they no longer act random.
Yes, that's right.
And so what we're interested in this project is looking at the correlations between our inference of worldwide events that attract a lot of interest,
mm-hmm.
and the relationship between those events and the appearance of order in these random generators.
Maybe I said creepy because a couple of times when I've been there, Dean, all of a sudden, it did kind of go berserk. I mean, I've had people, you know, email me and say, hey, Art, tonight the eggs are really going nuts. And so I'll get interested and I'll go take a look. And sure enough, it's gong, 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 gongs from everywhere. And it's just jumping around like crazy. And that's where the creepy comes from, because I have the feeling that I might be looking at the precursor to some kind of big event.
Well, it's possible. I mean,
yeah.
In a sense, you're looking at a form of the pulse of the planet. It's a form of pulsing that is much closer to mind than it might be to a heart. But, of course, you also have to keep in mind that when you're looking at random events, that it's very easy to start seeing patterns where there actually are no patterns.
Ah, the problem encountered really with the entire project, right?
That's right. That's right. And so we are very careful in our analyses to make predictions in advance and make analyses in advance. In other words, we use planned analyses so we don't fool ourselves into seeing patterns that aren't there.
Right. And now this has been going on. This project has been active for how long now, Dean?
It's in August it'll be 8 years.
8 years, yeah. of recording this, huh? Was
right.
It always roughly the size it is now, or has it grown during that 8 years?
No, it started with 3 random generators, and now it's stabilizing at about 70.
At about 70. So, again, so people understand, these individual computers, about 70 of them, scattered around the entire globe, mm-hmm. are spitting out as close to random as one can imagine, practically, I guess, really random numbers, and there is this tendency for the computers to simultaneously or very nearly simultaneously take off and become non-random, and that's when the alarms and the gongs and the bells go off, when this, depending on how much non-randomness there is. Now, over these 8 years, it has been studied very carefully. We've looked at very large world events like 9/11, like I'm sure the tsunami, the earthquake, things that have just affected the mind of just about everybody on the globe. What would you summarize as a result so far, Dean?
Well, there have been a total of 199 events,
mm-hmm.
of the types that you've mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Of those, 186 are considered formal events, formal in the sense that they're very precisely specified. And some of the others were more vague, so they're dropped from the formal analysis.
Okay.
So of the 186 formal events, the overall odds against chance, as of now, basically, is 50,000 to 1 in favor of order appearing when there shouldn't be any.
Oh, my God. So now you've got some numbers for us. The possibility of these 186 being reflected as however they have been, mm-hmm. in the project would be about 1 in 50,000.
That's right.
Odds are really starting to tip in our favor here, aren't they?
Well, the odds have fluctuated over time. At one time, they were over 1,000,000 to 1. And then they bounced down, and now they're bouncing back up again. So it's... we're beginning to learn now that we have so many different events that some of the events produce a measurable effect and others don't.
Hmm. Is there any pattern to the kind of event that produces a larger reaction?
We think so. For example, one type of event that we might think would produce a reaction in fact, does not, and that is natural disasters. So people have asked, well, what about the tsunami? The tsunami did not produce a significant result using our standard analysis.
Nor the earthquake that precipitated it?
No, nor the earthquake. But we've now, this is partially a result of the way that we analyze the data. You know, as I said, in order to be clear that we're not trying to look for patterns, we use a standard form of analysis that may not be appropriate for each one of these events. And so we've gone back now and looked at 55 events that we call impulse events.
Right.
These are things like earthquakes, terrorist attacks, and so on. They're not planned. They start at a very specific time, and then they persist for some time afterwards.
Yes.
When you look at those events, and by the way, most of those are natural disasters, besides the terrorist attacks, they're mostly natural disasters, which don't tend to give a very interesting result. You can do what's called a cross-correlation analysis, where you look at the moment that the event occurs, like the beginning of an earthquake, and then you slide in time the data, so you slide forward in time, you slide backwards in time, to see if the event has something like a precursor. You know, maybe there's nothing happening at time zero, but if you start going back 10 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour before the event, maybe there's something happening before.
Right.
Similar to what we saw in 9/11.
Right.
And as it turns out, there is. For these impulse events, the 55 impulse events, there is a precursor, and it kind of looks like a wave, the way the graph is drawn, that's between 2 and 4 hours in advance of the event itself.
That's fascinating.
So it's as a result of many years of analysis and looking at this in new ways that we're beginning to learn what happens in the network based on the kind of event that's coming up.
Now, so that I'm clear, with regard to the tsunami, was there that precursor?
That was an earthquake event and
yes,
part of the impulse, part of the 55 impulse events we looked at. So I don't know specifically for that specific event.
I guess I was going to ask whether it was just sort of human-oriented events. I don't know, like the United States going to war, for example, something that we were all aware of but still when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Whether in Earth movement-type events, geophysical events, where humans are not involved, there simply is not the kind of output that you can read.
Well, we have another analysis where the 55 events, by the way, were ones that were registered. We have a registry of these events. But, of course, the earthquake's happening all the time, and we didn't register all of them. So one type of analysis simply looked throughout the entire database where every time there was an earthquake of at least magnitude 7.
Right.
Some of them we got and some of them we had missed. And for those events as well, these kinds of other impulse events we had missed, they also show these effects.
Huh.
So, which makes it even more interesting, because what we're trying to do is see whether or not we as the analysts are just picking favorable times. You know, we're dealing with a large random walk here.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could somehow psychically or intuitively guess the right kind of event to choose, then maybe we're the result. You know, it's not like we're not creating patterns that aren't there, but we're impressing the pattern somehow through ourselves, and it has nothing to do with the global consciousness. But that kind of argument begins to go away if it turns out that we go to events that we had not considered previously, and they show an effect as well, and that does seem to be happening.
Can you name the kind of event that really has sent it off the charts?
Well, unfortunately, terrorism seems to do a pretty good job.
It does.
One of the largest effects ever was the first event, which were the embassy bombings back in 1998. That turned out to be Al-Qaeda, although we didn't know it yet.
Huh.
Bombs in Yugoslavia, big train crash in India. And then occasionally, these large-scale meditations will also produce a big effect.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah, these big planned meditations. One of the more recent effects was in Pope John's funeral.
Oh, yes.
That was predicted, and in fact, that got a significant result. And then an almost significant result for Prince Charles's wedding.
Really?
I don't know what to make of that.
Nor do I.
Previously, in Princess Di's funeral was a very large effect also.
Uh-huh.
So it's something like things that attract very large scale of attention by lots of people. Whereas, and unfortunately, negative events tend to do that more often than positive events. Whereas natural disasters will attract a lot of attention, but they tend to be diffuse. You know, they're spread out over long periods of time. And most people have an attitude of, while they're paying attention to it, it's tragic and yet unavoidable. So there's a different emotional valence that's associated with natural disasters that is not there when we're dealing with human events.
Hey, Dean, do you think that if we had, instead of one computer at each location, we had two computers at each location, with one of the computers in each case being inside a Faraday cage, do you think the output would be any different at all?
No. And the reason I say that is because the random number generators are actually built inside metal boxes. So,
huh.
so the guts of the generator, which is based on quantum noise,
are shielded.
Is already shielded. And the box is connected to the computer, and the computer is grounded. So
boy, oh boy, oh boy.
It's in a pretty good cage already. And actually, another interesting question that we looked at is, what would happen, given that we get data from each device every second, what would happen if we looked at the entire analysis for the even seconds and then looked for the odd seconds?
Huh.
Would we get a similar result?
And?
The answer is yes, you do.
What
that means is that whatever's going on is acting as though it's an external effect, which is consistent with the idea that there's something out there which is impressing itself into the generator.
God, isn't that fascinating? Isn't that fascinating? Anybody have any guesses about how that could be happening? I suppose it jumps right up into the quantum world, huh?
It's something to do with quantum mechanics, probably, and it is acting as though it was a field. I mean, we talk about field consciousness, and we use that initially as kind of a metaphor, but it seems to behave in that way. It's as though the medium itself, physical medium that we live in, is not purely like classical physics has said, but it involves something else. Whether the something else is mind or consciousness, we don't quite know. But the medium itself seems to be modulated in some way. Because otherwise, all of the usual ways of thinking about electromagnetic interference and so on, they just don't work by design.
Huh.
The random generator is hidden from all that.
Well, maybe whoever wrote the line in Star Wars about, may the force be with you. Hey, Dean, you know, it was a while ago that you and I first talked, and since that time, I've had a range of guests on, Dean, a giant range of guests, and it's sort of like the whole thing has exploded.
Which thing are you referring to?
Well, I don't know. The whole consciousness thing has exploded. The awareness of this power, if it is a power, this field, you said field, I guess that's a good word for it, the existence of this field has been discussed by guests in all kinds of different, with all kinds of different interests, let me put it that way. So, my goodness, awareness is way up in this field, isn't it?
Yeah, I would agree. I think we first spoke maybe 8 or 9 years ago.
Exactly.
And since then, the academic interest and popular interest in consciousness and quantum mechanics and how they might interact really has exploded.
Right through the roof.
Yeah. I spent all day yesterday being interviewed for the next version of the movie, What the Bleep? What the Bleep Do We Know?
No kidding.
Yeah. So that's an example of a combination of theatrical film and documentary basically came out of the blue and has been a wild success. I mean, and who would have thought that a movie that's trying to portray the meaning of quantum mechanics would be a big success.
Who would have thought?
Yeah.
Now that there are these additional years under the belt of the project itself, is it beginning to gather enough evidence so that that more academics are going, I guess we better take a look at this?
I wouldn't say that the Global Consciousness Project alone has done that.
Right.
There's a confluence of additional evidence from other kinds of psi experiments, but the combined evidence is becoming strong enough now that it's difficult for people not to pay attention to it anymore. I mean, if someone really doesn't want to pay attention, they can ignore it very, very nicely. But for the many of the rest of us who are open-minded about it and recognize that if it's true, it's quite important, the strength of the overall evidence is pretty solid.
I wonder, Dean, as awareness of consciousness as a field or a force becomes generalized, if that would affect significantly, for example, the results being gathered at Princeton. I would imagine it certainly could, couldn't it?
Yeah, it would affect that, and it could also affect the any kind of experiment that involves consciousness in some way.
Yes.
I mean, we know just from laboratory experiments that motivation is an extremely important element in these experiments. So if there's something like a building public excitement and interest, that will invariably affect these experiments.
Do you think, Dean, and I know this is asking you to walk way out on a plank that you probably wouldn't want to walk out on, but do you think that massive amounts of public consciousness directed could have an effect on a thing or a system like weather or complex systems, a small effect with a big ending, perhaps the butterfly effect kind of thing, I don't know, or maybe even something stronger than that. Could it affect things?
Well, we know that the answer is yes, or at least that's what the data is suggesting. I mean, the Global Consciousness Project is looking specifically at that very issue. It's a little bit different in that what you're asking is whether focused intention and lots of people could do it. My guess is yes. We know that simple attention, and not even focused attention, but just attention on something, anything, will make a small effect in these generators. The problem with, I mean, you can imagine something like a television show or a radio show where millions of people are asked to simultaneously think certain thoughts or to direct their thoughts.
Yes.
The problem is that these phenomena seem to be involved in some way with the notion of coherence. It's not simply that there's a lot of stuff being thrown, but it's stuff of a certain kind.
Mm-hmm.
And by analogy, in the mysteries in quantum mechanics are due to something called quantum coherence. And if you don't have quantum coherence, then all of the mystery goes away, basically. It looks like a classical system. That seems to be true for these kinds of effects as well.
All right. In quantum mechanics, it's my understanding that two cells that have come from the same place on opposite ends of the Earth will be noted to react the same way at the same time. I've had really good scientists on here trying to explain to me how this might be. I can't wrap my brain around the fact that there's not a kind of a communication taking place in the way we understand it, going at light speed. But obviously it doesn't go at any speed. It's beyond speed. It's beyond time, it seems. So this field, how is it allowing two objects to react the same way at the same time? In some way, certainly, we can't grasp.
Well, the reason why it's difficult to grasp is because common sense tells us, and classical physics formalizes a model of the world which involves, which essentially is like a large clockwork mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
It's a world in which space is absolute and time is absolute,
mm-hmm.
and things work by balls and sticks, touching each other.
And communication doesn't go faster than the speed of light.
That's right.
Right. So
and so all of the our usual ways of thinking, if somebody says, how do you explain this phenomena of, say, entanglement? How do you explain it? What they have in mind is an explanation which has to do with clockwork gears and that sort of thing. But we're really talking fundamentally here about the fabric of reality. What is the fabric of physical reality? Quantum mechanics says it is something completely unlike what common sense tells us. And that's why it's so difficult to wrap your mind around it.
Right.
I can tell, the interpretation that I resonate with was the one that David Bohm gave, which is that we live in a holistic medium. The physical fabric of reality is a holistic medium, which means that everything coexists with everything else. He called it the implicate order. Our common sense shows us the explicate order, the world of appearances. But underneath it is the implicate order in which everything is wrapped around everything else. It all coexists. So when you see an example of either two particles which are entangled, as in the physics lab, or, I think, telepathy, two people who are entangled and at a distance, the reason why it appears as though there's a signal between the two, that is an appearance, it's not actually what's happening. What actually is happening is that we're seeing two things which at some deep level are actually the same thing.
That's hard. That's really hard.
I've developed this idea to say, let's just assume that the quantum mechanics are telling us that we really do live in a holistic environment. One way of thinking of it is we all live in this giant bowl of clear jello, and you're kind of locked in place in this jello, but any movement, any action, any thought will ripple out and affect the entire rest of the pool of jello that we all are living in. So this is not quite right, because in jello things are in separate locations, but it's a metaphor. So in this medium that we live in, everything is affecting everything else. Everything reverberates out and is touching and feeling everything else. That means that the physical brain is entangled with everything else. Every movement, every electrical activity, every thought is radiating out.
And it certainly would explain a lot of the otherwise inexplicable, wouldn't it?
Well, if you then go through, you say, okay, let's assume that's true. What would that be like if that were true? What would it feel like experientially,
mm-hmm.
if in fact at some deep level everything is connected? And I went through the list of known psychic effects that people report, and they all make sense. It makes sense from a point of view that there are no signals passing, and it's not like there are lightning bolts coming out of your head that somehow go to the right place. All of the phenomena like remote viewing and telepathy and precognition and so on, they make sense from a point of view of a different kind of physical medium that we live in, as opposed to some kind of exotic force.
Do you think that conventional physics is going to ever be able to deal with it?
I think we're getting close. I think, you know, the ontological implications of quantum mechanics are nowhere near worked out. And I also don't think that quantum mechanics is the end of the road in physics. It's just the latest road in physics. But if you follow the history of physics from classical to quantum, and then where it's pointing beyond that, I think that the answer is definitely yes. We will eventually understand psychic and mystical experience from a scientific point of view, and it's going to be related very closely to what physics says about the nature of the medium in which we live.
Well, I'll tell you, that'll be the day when traditional physicists are explaining to us how people are able to read other people's minds, or can draw a bridge that somebody's looking at half a world away and the environment they're in.
I think it's going to be sooner than we might think.
That'll be the day, won't it? It's going to be hard for them. Or maybe it won't.
I actually don't think it's going to be hard at all.
You don't think so?
No, because when the time comes that all of the ideas fall together, it'll suddenly make sense. And then people will, you know, they'll hit themselves in the head saying, well, why in the world did it take so long to figure this out? And I think one of the keys that we'll probably see within the next decade will be a demonstration of bioentanglement.
Bioentanglement. What would that be like?
Well, what we see in the physics labs now are entanglement of elementary particles.
Right.
So it might be called physical entanglement.
Right.
Bioentanglement is when we start seeing that in living systems. We'll first see it in things like biomolecules, and then we'll see it in enzymes, and eventually bacteria, and so on. There's no theoretical reason why such entanglement cannot exist. We haven't seen it yet, but that's more due to limitations in apparatus that we have rather than a theoretical reason.
Doesn't mean it's not going on now.
Well, I think it is going on. See, this new book that I've written called Entangled Minds, the whole theme in the book is saying that if we follow this sequence of logic from classical to quantum physics and then entanglement and bioentanglement and so on, if we keep going in that, eventually we're going to end up with entanglement at the human level, in minds, entangled minds. What would that be like? Well, there are experiments that we've already done, we've been doing for decades, that suggest that two people can exchange information, both consciously and unconsciously, at a distance and well-shielded and all the rest, and we never find any forces. We don't find any signals. We don't find any reduction of the ability at a distance. All of that doesn't make sense from a classical physics perspective. It makes a lot of sense from a quantum perspective.
When we hear about two or three or four inventors virtually working on or inventing roughly the same thing and getting into patent fights and all the rest of it, as so frequently happens, are we seeing, do you think, some sort of entanglement that's occurring in human minds at the same exact instant?
It may well be. I mean, that phenomenon may be similar to spontaneous telepathy that occurs between people.
Huh.
Especially given in that case, and with inventors, they're all kind of thinking along the same lines anyway.
You know, right.
There's always multiple people working on the same problem.
Right.
But if the same novel idea arises in a bunch of people at the same time,
it seems to.
It looks like there's some large-scale correlation that has been created. And that is essentially what an entangled system would look like.
Well, it causes plenty of entanglements, that's for sure, because people automatically say to themselves, Bull, this was my idea. I know exactly when it occurred to me. I know when the light bulb went off. This was mine.
In a truly entangled, holistic system, there is no isolation. Nothing belongs to anyone. It all belongs to everything. I mean, it would take a really significant change of worldview to get your mind wrapped around that.
Well, maybe one day we'll see a lawyer defending somebody with a defense of quantum entanglement.
I can envision that.
Yes.
I can see that.
So can I. He had the idea because he had the idea because the idea was there. And
the idea permeates us all, and some people were more sensitive to it than others. By the way, we're going to talk about these and many similar things at the IONS conference, which is coming up July 6th through 11th.
The IONS conference?
The Institute of Noetic Science. Every 2 years, we have a conference. We try to bring together all of the leading-edge thinkers having to do with consciousness and healing, spirituality, psi research, quantum physics, and so on. And so if you're interested in hearing a cell biologist and an astrophysicist debate a mystic and a monk, then this is the conference for you.
It ought to be one hell of a year.
Yep.
I'll say that. I mean, this is hot stuff right now. It really is hot stuff.
Well, so it's coming up in July 6th through 11th in Arlington, Virginia. You can look it on our website and see all about it.
I'm imagining it will be very well attended.
Well, we hope so.
I think so.
We face an interesting embarrassment here, in a sense. It's like an embarrassment of riches.
Yes.
When the Institute of Noetic Sciences started out some 30 years ago, discussing consciousness in a serious way was considered the farthest fringe. It was like nuts. to talk about consciousness.
Absolutely.
And it really has exploded now. It's become almost, in fact, it has become mainstream, even within the scientific community. So it's becoming more difficult to get a large convention of people simply because there are many conventions that are doing this now. We like to think our conventions are better, but, you know, I'm biased.
So this is the way, through conventions like this, that we will begin to grasp an understanding of how big this is, what it all means. I mean, there are so many, questions about it.
Well, you know, the conventions are designed for public discussion.
Right.
And mostly your scientists and scholars who are giving the presentations, but it's for a public audience. There are other conferences which are designed for scientific audiences. And I think that's really where the leading edge action is taking place. And there's some very interesting things to report about that.
Oh?
For example, the 10 years ago, I may have mentioned the Invisible College.
I think you did, yes.
This refers to scientists and academics who are very, very interested in these topics, including psi, but who have been very reluctant to talk about it. Because there's this taboo that you're not supposed to talk about certain things.
Of course.
The size of that Invisible College has been really increasing in the same way that public interest has been increasing. But it is also beginning to morph in an interesting way. Some of the people in academia now, some of whom are very distinguished folks holding endowed chairs at major universities,
yes,
have been conducting their own psi research successfully.
And quietly, I think.
And not talking about it.
Uh-huh.
And since I'm a bit of a lightning rod for these things, I get contacted by lots of people all over the place.
Obviously, many of you are very interested in all of this. The Conscious Universe is Dean's book. You ought to grab that, Amazon.com. The Conscious Universe, that's a starting point. The conference coming up is another. Dean, again with the conference, please. When is it going to be? And more importantly, how do people line up to get in, or what do they have to do?
The conference is officially titled Consciousness and Healing. It's July 6th through 11th in Arlington, Virginia, which is right next to Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And the place to go, easy place to go to register is the IONS website, which is www.ions.org. And it's featured on the homepage, so you'll see it right off the bat.
That's easy. www.ions.org.
Right.
Very good. I really think there are going to be a lot of people there, deservedly so. You know, I sort of joked this could become a new religion the way humans are these days. Probably it could, or maybe it's an old religion, or maybe it's going to be both.
I think that there's an exciting element here in that people... I mean, it is often said that the reason why magic and religion persist is because of uncertainty. You know, we would like to have safe, predictable lives, but we don't.
Right.
And so we look for answers elsewhere. I don't think we'll ever, as humans anyway, be completely risk-free, but science and spirituality are beginning, not exactly to merge, but at least... In the old days, like water and oil, they would immediately separate. Well, now we're getting to something which is where the oil and the water are beginning to penetrate a little bit.
That's right.
And the universe is not ending. So I think it's a very exciting time where the rationality and precision of thinking in science is beginning to address issues which are of very deep interest to a lot of people.
I wonder how many years away the day is when a scientist says... We can now explain how somebody reads somebody else's mind. We can tell you how it happens or the way it happens. Maybe not so long, huh?
I would say that we're within 2 or 3 decades.
That's exciting.
The language. I think the principal problem is going to be one of language initially. We'll have to come up with different ways of describing events which are outside the scope of common sense, and that's always been difficult. But that's why science is full of jargon, basically. You know, if you're trying to take a mathematical explanation and someone says, well, how do you describe that in words? Sometimes you can't. You have to come up with new words.
Well, you've explained as best you could this to me, but honestly, I still am you know, I'm a speed of light guy, and I'm a communication is taking place kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's taking place faster than light or in a way that we don't yet understand, I'm still a guy who thinks that particle A has to talk to particle B through some medium, that there has to be communication there for the same thing to happen at the same time.
Right.
And in the physical universe that I've been brought up in, there's no way to explain that.
That's right. And that's exactly where the resistance has come from.
And the Jell-O didn't get it for me.
Yeah, the Jell-O is not quite right, because it's not really a medium of that sort. But I've been really struggling to try to find metaphors, and there are no metaphors. You know, this idea of a connective medium is not new.
Right.
It's the basis of Eastern philosophy, basically.
That's why I said maybe old religion.
Right. And there, the metaphor, the two metaphors have been used in the Eastern approach. One is that that the medium is like the ocean, and that what we see as independent objects are droplets that are pushed up by waves in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So they're momentarily there, and they will have their own little existence, but then they drop down and they become absorbed into the larger medium. That's one way of thinking of it. And the other one is a metaphor of a forest, where you look at two leaves on a tree, and the leaves are shaking the same way at the same time, and it looks like one is sending a signal to the other.
Mm.
But in fact, they're connected to the same trunk, and the trunk is shaking, and it's a common cause that is giving rise to two things which are separate, and yet they're not separate in another sense.
It's going to have to be a whole new way of... there will have to be new words, and there will have to be new ways of understanding to even begin to approach this.
Right. It will require a major shift in worldview. And those kinds of things do not happen quickly. So even though everything else is accelerating, information is accelerating and so on, this is a big one, because it's probably similar in some ways to 1905, when Einstein came out with his theory of relativity. And it took a long, long time for people to begin to wrap their mind around what he meant.
True enough.
You know, it took a couple generations. Well, this is more difficult than that, so it'll take even longer. But it'll happen.
Is there a father of this? Is there an Einstein yet for this? Is there somebody we should look to as authoring the beginning of the understanding of this?
I don't think so. Not yet. I mean, at some point, someone will be very clever and figure out a way to describe this in ways where people say, oh, that's how it works.
Right.
We're not there yet. But that's partially because the implications of quantum mechanics are not worked out yet. We really don't understand yet many of the fundamental mysteries, and it's partially because of this language issue.
Is it probable that there is immense power somehow entangled with all of this, that there will be a power?
Every new piece of information or knowledge carries power. Knowledge is power.
Mm-hmm.
So is there power? Yes. It's a peculiar sort of power, though, because in a holistic medium, yet another metaphor is, it's as though you're trying to examine your eye by looking in a mirror.
Right.
There are certain ways you can look and see directly into the fovea, but it's very difficult or even impossible to look at the side of your eye using your eye. And in the whole point about a holistic medium that makes it difficult to understand is that it involves recursion at every level. You can't poke it without it poking back and changing in the process.
When you say holistic, you mean the connected aspect of everything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everything is connected. It sounds a little bit like a tautology. You know, arguments that involved, that seem to be empty. It's like an empty argument because everything is everything. And yet, that does seem to be what quantum mechanics, at least one interpretation of it, a number of theoretical physicists are beginning to propose the idea that everything really is connected to everything else.
Mm-hmm. It clearly seems to be the field that remote viewers work in. Have you looked carefully at remote viewing, skeptically at remote viewing, and what conclusions have you come to?
Well, remote viewing is not that different from telepathy and precognition and all the rest. While I've looked at all of the experiments in great gory detail, when you look at the whole batch of them, the reason why I just use the word psi, it's just a placeholder for some form of connected information flow.
Mm-hmm.
And the one point is your head, and the other points are anywhere in the universe, anywhere in space and time.
So it would seem.
Yes. And so the evidence is quite strong that while it sounds kind of nutty as compared to what common sense tells us, the phenomena still exist. And the phenomena don't seem to care whether we think it's nutty or not. They don't go away.
All right. I've been told by some recent guests, Dean, that as quickly as it seems to be exploding here, in China, for example, they don't have the same scientific prejudices that we have here, and that all of this is moving much, much faster. And they may be approaching an understanding faster than we are, or have the basic ability to think about things in a different way that allows them to be ahead of us in this area. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I've heard something very similar just recently.
You have?
I would guess that you're correct, that part of it is a different language, a different cultural history, and probably somewhat less of a taboo.
Mm-hmm.
In the academic world. And so, yes. So at some point, the Chinese may be well ahead of the rest of the world in understanding.
Mm.
Of course, the fear that arises is the one that you already mentioned, which is knowledge is power. So if someone gets a significant increase over somebody else in terms of understanding, then that probably can be used in some way.
Used. Dean, there would be one school of thought in remote viewing, and it's certainly predominant, that you might be able to look at something on the other side of the world and describe it. You might be able to find something. You might be able to learn if somebody's alive or dead, or you might even be able to discern what their line of thinking is.
Mm-hmm.
But remote viewers are very careful to talk about remote influencing, that But some of them do admit that, indeed, it may be possible, and that would be that an individual or a group of people intent with will on influencing the mind of another on the other side of the world might be able to do that. Is this something that your imagination says might be possible?
Well, it's more than imagination. The laboratory evidence suggests that that's true. We don't know whether the word influence is exactly correct, but we do know that if you take two people and separate them and have one think thoughts at the other, that the other person's body will respond. And so you don't need a large leap of faith to imagine that the right kind of training or talent in one person could affect another. I mean, what we see in the lab are basically an arousal of the autonomic nervous system. It would be like as though you gave somebody a triple espresso drink.
Hmm.
You know, they'd become jittery. So we see that. We can see that in the laboratory, and it's not even that difficult to produce that kind of experiment anymore. So if we amplify that up, we scale it up a few thousand times, if that were possible, then I could imagine you could start pushing around somebody's blood pressure or make them particularly anxious at a distance. Whether it has a healing response and whether it has a damaging response to the person, I don't think we know enough.
Equally possible.
I'd have to say it's possible, We don't see that in the lab, but we're not generally trying to do that in the lab either.
Many of spirituality suggests that, no, the negative can't be done. The universe won't allow it, you know, that only good things, healing and so forth, can be accomplished. But there are others. For example, I've interviewed some witches,
mm-hmm.
Dean, and they say, hogwash. It is what it is. They have different names for it, but they can say it can be a negative force as easily as it can be a positive force. It's simply dependent upon the intent, you know, of the person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably correct. I mean, partially because our notion of what's good and bad are relative.
Indeed so.
So if you might be doing a very good patriotic act, which involves harming somebody at a distance, but it's for the good of the larger whole. It still means it's a negative event, but maybe it's not so negative from another perspective. So
it's all in perspective.
That's right.
But you think you do imagine something like that, a negative effect on somebody, could be achieved?
Yeah, I think that's plausible given what we know.
Huh. That seems to me to be something that would be so outrageous and such a gigantic power that we could not afford, and when I say we, I mean, you know, our government, our leaders could not afford to not take notice of all this building proof leading to something like that possibility.
Well, I hope people are paying attention.
Well, they've got a lot to pay attention to these days, and that probably seems rather sort of, you know, off the wall and esoteric to them.
Right.
And but I don't think so, Dean.
Well, but also keep in mind that as with any form of force or power, there are many ways of getting a job done. So it's probably much, much easier to use conventional methods if you wanted to make somebody feel ill than it would be to have a billion-dollar crash program and finding the best psychics in the world to do it. So that as a use of this phenomena would not seem to be a very wise use of the money.
Well, perhaps not. But are we? I mean, as far as I know, the remote viewing program has been terminated. And when you speak with remote viewers, they say that it was basically because of the embarrassment of those involved and even doing something that off the wall.
Mm-hmm.
They claim very good success in the program, and that as not the reason that it was terminated, not because it wasn't reliable, not because it didn't work, but because people were embarrassed.
That's probably true. Yeah, I mean, we know the phenomena exist. We know that there are some very talented people who can use it. But again, it kind of comes down to the same question of if we have multiple ways of getting information, and some of them are very highly reliable technologies, then why bother with this other method? And, I mean, the answer to that is that this other method can do things that other technologies cannot, but it involves humans, and so it's not going to be perfect, and you have to be willing to put up with that. So that's part of the issue. There are also issues of personnel and who's running the program and all kinds of other political things that come into play.
Well, that's certainly true. Is there any indication to you that the government, with all this explosive interest, is seeing any of the implications of this? Have they reached out and touched anybody yet?
I don't know. Well, of course, if I did know, I couldn't say. But I'm not being coy.
That's
really
also
don't
a
know.
Very good answer. And you're right. Of course, you could not say. But it's hard for me to imagine that some forward-thinking people in our Defense Department wouldn't want to know what's going on here.
I can guarantee that there are forward-looking people in the Defense Department who do pay attention to this. Whether they do something about it or not is a whole other matter. But people are paying attention.
When those eggs went crazy before 9/11, I say before 9/11, before the event actually occurred itself, I wonder what they were reacting to. Dean, now, it's egocentric probably to believe that it's just human consciousness that that's causing the jumping up and down when it does. But, you know, really, if you take the holistic approach, then it's not just human consciousness. It might be the consciousness of every living thing on Earth, or maybe even beyond living things. I don't know. Do you?
No, but we have been looking at this issue. One of the ways of looking at it that I've looked at is on New Year's. Y2K is the one I spent most time on, but okay. We've looked at it for the other New Year's that we have in the database as well. And the interesting thing about New Year's is that it's a very predictable moment, typically around 5 seconds, that happens at the transition of New Year's in each time zone.
Right.
So for Y2K, since it had the largest effect. I looked at the 7 years of New Year's that we have, and five of them showed similar effects in the same direction.
Huh.
And 2 years, for some reason, had effects in the opposite direction.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why. So I looked in more detail at Y2K and decided to separate the time zones from high population time zones and low population time zones.
Right.
As it turns out, that for the time zones that are over the Pacific Ocean and pieces of the Atlantic, there's hardly anybody there. And then for the rest, over land masses, there's lots of people. So I created a partition of approximately 6 billion people in some of the time zones and somewhere around 5 or 6 million people in the remainders, mostly islands in the Pacific. And if we're dealing with something that is related to human consciousness, then we would expect a much larger effect for the 6 billion people than for the 6 million people.
Absolutely.
And in fact, you do get one. You get a difference in the direction that the high population time zones had a bigger effect for Y2K than in the other time zones.
That's a wow.
Yeah, so that suggests that the whales and dolphins don't care, or they don't know that Y2K is occurring, and the insects don't seem to care, nor do the rocks.
Right. I guess that's the way you end up proving all of this, with experiments exactly like that. You begin to break it down. I had never thought of doing that, but you're saying it tracked.
It did seem to track, yeah. It's not a wildly significant difference. The odds against chance are 80 to 1, but it's something. You know, it's in the predicted direction, and it would be considered statistically significant. We'll just have to take other events like this. And, of course, New Year's is a unique event in that it only has meaning in each time zone.
So all right.
We haven't really found other events that are easy to test in this way.
Good point. Dean, how's the support at Princeton for the continuation of this whole experiment?
Well, the leader of the project, Roger Nelson, is retired now. So the university is not associated with this at all anymore.
Okay.
Other than through Roger, who's now emeritus.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me it should be at that level somehow or another. So where have the reins now gone?
Roger is still very active. In fact, more active in this project now as the leader.
Oh.
In retirement, because he has other duties he doesn't have to do anymore. So that's why the website has been changed recently to Roger and others are refining it, and they've split it in more clearly into two parts. There's a part that has to do with the technical and the scientific side, and then the second part, which has to do with the aesthetic and poetic notions of global consciousness. Last May, the major analysts got together for a conference, and we were discussing what should we do next and what are the analyses that we want to focus on next.
I'd be interested in that. What should you do next?
Well, part of the issue is looking at things like these impulse events.
Mm-hmm.
You know, given now that we have almost 8 years of data, we're able to look at long-term trends. We're beginning to look at things like environmental issues and whether mm-hmm. Whether they make a difference. For a long time, we've been discussing the notion of having a parallel network. I mean, in order to really nail down the issue of what is causing this effect, is it us, the experimenters, or is it the world? One way to do that would be to have a completely parallel network that we don't look at the data until we've already analyzed the data in the first network.
Yeah, that'd be good.
And that way, if we get an interesting effect in the first network, then we go back and look at the second one, and if we get the effect there as well, it begins to lessen the possibility that it was that we created it somehow.
Hmm.
This is the same reason why we look at even and odd seconds.
Right.
And so far, using this the one network that we have, the evidence is pointing in the direction that we're not solely responsible for these results. They seem to be arising from some other place.
Okay. What is the Love Study? What was that?
The Love Study refers to an experiment in entangled minds and bodies, where you take a couple, and a bonded couple of some type, typically a spouse or spouses, and separate them in two places, monitor both of their physiologies, and stimulate one of them with the live video image of the other.
Right.
And when that stimulation occurs, to look in the body of the non-stimulated person to see whether or not they respond. So conceptually, it's as though you take two people, you separate them, you poke one of them, and you see if the other one flinches.
Uh-huh.
We call it the Love Study because, in this case, they're long-term bonded couples, one of whom is undergoing treatment for cancer.
Uh-huh.
And so the partner of that patient is trained in something we call compassionate intention.
Mm-hmm.
It's to give the partner something to do for their loved one. It's to send them beneficial thoughts. They go through this training process, and then they practice it daily for 3 months. And then they come in the lab, and we see whether or not there's some kind of connection between the two at a distance. Not necessarily a healing connection, but a physiological reaction.
So, and you find it?
We do. We also have another condition, which are people who have not yet been trained. So they're the couples, one of whom has cancer. So these couples, by the way, are extremely motivated to have some form of connected feeling. This is unusual in a laboratory experiment because you can't fake that kind of motivation. So they're extremely motivated. They really want these connections to work.
Of course.
We have the trained group, we have a weight group, and then we have a control group of healthy couples where there are no health issues around. So we're essentially looking at the role of training and of motivation in this experiment.
And how strong is the result?
Overall, if you combine all of the people, 40 couples went through this, it's very clear evidence that one person's thought does have an impact on another person's body. What we have not found is significant evidence that the training made any difference.
Really?
And I think it's partially because there's a strong correlation between the degree to which the sending person responds to the stimulus and the degree to which the receiver reacts. So in the worst case, you have a sender, like a sender-receiver pair. The sender falls asleep. And so they're not responding at all.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, the receiver doesn't respond at all either. So oftentimes people don't fall asleep in the experiment, but if you've been doing a daily meditation practice for 3 months, you get so used to having your body become very relaxed so quickly that you simply don't respond very much anymore to any kind of stimulus. So I think what we may be seeing here, that what appears to be evidence that the training is not working, might be confounded by the fact that the trained people are simply not reacting as much.
Hmm.
And we can see that because we look at the physiology of the sender, and the trained senders are not responding as much as the untrained senders.
Well, you remember a little while ago I asked you about perhaps it was more than just people, maybe animals, maybe even things. But my mind goes back to this really incredible 2020 experiment. It was on 2020 on TV. You know, the classic one about the master coming home at odd times.
Right.
And the dog knowing that the master's coming home. I mean, there's just no question about it. They had the video on the dog. God, you could see the dog knew the master was on the way home at this unknown time. That dog knew.
Right.
Now, that would seem to be the same kind of thing that we're talking about, except between human and animal.
I agree. Yeah,
you do.
Yeah. I think it is the same phenomena. When we look at the receivers in this experiment, the way that their body responds is not exactly the same way that the sender responds. Because after all, the receiver in this experiment are sitting in a shielded room for 30 minutes and nothing happens. They're just sitting there. Of course, they're wired up. But you can tell when you look at the physiological reaction that it is as though they're just sitting there quietly, and they suddenly get a small startle, as though they heard their name called.
Right.
Something whispered. Something catches their attention. And when that happens, the body goes through a very predictable sequence of changes, and that's the kind of change that we see. So it's as though, psychically, they're picking up that attention is being placed on them. And that's probably what's happening in the case of a dog that's responding. That suddenly attention is there, and they pay attention to it.
Strongly. I mean, if anything, perhaps the dogs seem to me to be more reactive than most humans. It was just
well, remember
incredible.
That dog might be the one in a million dog. In the studies we do in the lab with people, we work with volunteers who are not pre-calibrated.
Well, that's true.
So if we had the opportunity of scanning through a million people or a million couples, we could probably find a couple that was as good as that dog was.
You know, you mentioned whispering and whispering in the ear earlier in the program that, you know, you get to hear things about research that's going on perhaps not so publicly.
Mm-hmm.
Without telling us who's doing that research, can you give us an idea of what areas of research are being pursued privately and quietly?
I would say that there is telepathy research being done successfully. Mm-hmm. Telepathy is basically blasé already. I mean, I did an analysis recently of all of the experiments on telepathy from 1974 up through last year.
Right.
There's 3,145 trials of a particular type of experiment. And the overall odds against chance are 29 quintillion to 1.
Oh, my God.
Quintillion means 18 zeros.
And so I
wrote this up, and it'll appear in my next book that's coming out. And it's just one class of a number of different classes of experiments that show this stuff is real. So these kinds of information has penetrated out into people in academia, and they're interested, and some are beginning to replicate it, and successfully so. But the other area, which is, I think, much more radical and, in a sense, more interesting, is precognition.
Uh-huh.
People are looking at unconscious precognition in the body. And one way of thinking of it is, when you talk about precognition, everybody freaks out because it's very difficult to get your mind wrapped around it. But if you talk about it in terms of intuition, unconscious intuition, or preconscious processing, there are lots of euphemisms that are used for this now. People are beginning to replicate experiments that I started back in 1995 because they're basically very standard psychophysiology experiments, and it's easy to hide what you're interested in. And I now know a number of groups that have been doing this and have been successful.
When the needles went off the chart prior to the 9/11 event, was that precognitive?
Well, that looks like a large-scale premonition. Yeah, I mean, it's precognitive in the sense that something was happening before an event unfolded.
Yes.
But it's quite different than what's happening in an individual. Maybe it was an effect of of lots of individuals. But actually, this reminds me that we found it, and the last time I was on, I talked about an effect we found that was a precognitive effect in some of our online games. And I found another one that has actually confirmed the first one.
Oh.
Should I talk about that?
Please.
Okay, the first one was, we have at the gotsci.org site. This was a set of games that I wrote originally for the Boundary Institute.
Everybody's going to want to know, you better spell it out carefully, the gotsci.
Gotsci. It's a takeoff after got milk. So it's gotpsi.org.
Ah.
Gotsci.org.
gotpsi.org. Okay.
Right. This is hosted by the Boundary Institute, which mm-hmm. I co-founded with Richard Chaup back in 2000. And this was originally designed as a suite of simple games that are all valid psi testing games, one of which is a simple card test. You have to choose which one of the five cards that appears on the screen do you think that the computer will then select. So it's a precognition test.
Right.
On that test, you can create a daily performance measure of the degree to which people are successful in selecting the card.
Huh.
So we have now this for several years' worth of data, including going before, during, and after 9/11.
Huh.
And what we found was that on a daily basis, there was a massive drop of in performance about 2 weeks before 9/11, which persisted for 2 weeks, and then a day or two before 9/11, it suddenly shot back up to chance. So visually, there's like this giant notch going down just before 9/11. And my speculation was that since a downward curve with a performance curve means that people are missing the correct target too often, way too often. I mean, statistically, this is thousands to one against chance for 2 weeks. Almost as though they were psychically repressing their ability.
So you're watching in both directions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They could either hit high or they could hit low, basically. They were missing. And the missing effect is much, much stronger than any other direction in this data. I mean, there's nothing else like it in this database.
Huh.
And since it happens in a meaningful time, so close to 9/11, the speculation was that people were essentially intending to miss. They were unconsciously doing it. So an unconscious intention is repression. They repressed their psychic ability because they didn't want to walk around feeling what was about to unfold. So that was what
That's fascinating.
I talked about that, I think, last time I was on. So then I looked at another game that we have there, which is a remote viewing game.
Well, at Coast to Coast, we're experts at crashing websites. Let's see how we can do with gotpsi.org. That's where the games are. Now, these games test PSI ability. Various games up there that test PSI ability. And again, they're at gotpsi.org, gotpsi.org. Very easy. Now, Dean, I may have brushed on this some years ago with you, but do you individually track results? Do you have gongs and sirens go off if some sort of savant gets on the page and knocks them down one after the other?
Well, we do track. I wouldn't say we have gongs and sirens.
Well, I'm dramatic, you know.
Yeah, but yes, we do track individual performance. That's also one of the features of this website. By the way, there's another one that is associated with the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which is PsiArcade, PsiArcade.com.
All right.
So PsiArcade is another set of games. We do track them. We do use the data for research, and I was going to describe one finding in the research that was related to 9/11.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so we have a remote viewing test at gotsci.org. It's a simple test where the user is asked to describe a picture that the computer will randomly select.
Huh.
And the way that they do this is they enter some words in a box, and then the words are matched against the actual picture when it shows up. So I was thinking, maybe if premonitions are intruding in people's thoughts, that before 9/11, maybe people would be describing things having to do with terrorism.
Sure.
Because they're being asked to be in a reverie state and to imagine what's about to show up. The thing is, all of the pictures, in fact, in this set, there's 200 pictures, they're all very benign things. They're animals and scenery and beaches and that sort of thing. Nothing that would be considered terrorism.
Uh-huh.
But nevertheless, I figured, let's go look.
Sure.
So I started looking on September 9th, 2001.
Right.
On September 9th, which was a Sunday, at 8:48 Eastern Time, a user wrote had three trials in a row, and these are the words that this person wrote. Airliner seen from left rear against stormy cloud backdrop, flashes of streaky clouds, two persons.
Wow.
That's what the person entered for the first trial, which is a really bad description of the picture that ultimately came up.
Yes.
But it was kind of interesting given 9/11. So
yeah,
very next trial said, firstly, a dragonfly with a question mark, then a log or branch suggestive of the Everglades, then a fast dynamic scene of falling between two tall buildings.
Wow.
Past checkered patterns of windows.
Wow.
Followed by a third trial where he says, tall structure like an industrial chimney, flashes of rounded crenulated form, peacock-like headdress of American Indian woman, then surface like volcanic ash plume or cauliflower. If you take these three trials, and this, by the way, was all that this person entered, these three trials, those trials together are very much like an impressionistic snapshot.
Absolutely.
Or a way of describing what happened without saying exactly what it was.
Right. No question about it.
And then the next day, September 10th, 2001, at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, somebody writes, it is of something falling. It will be a chaotic scene.
Wow.
Another person says, intense, too hot to handle, blasting. Wow. Is the coast clear? They were checking the coast. And then the last one that matched was a series of 11 trials that a person entered 1 hour before the first airplane crashed into the World Trade Center. And these are the words. White House, gone in the blink of an eye, scald, man's folly, band red, surging, palace, not easily conned, U.S. power base, flexing muscles, and surprise.
Wow.
So some of these are really startling.
Yeah, that is startling. How did you feel when you read those?
Well, my hair stood up. How could somebody be having this? So there were 900 trials that were entered between September 9th and September 11th, 2001. So I decided to look through the entire database, which consisted of 256,000 trials, to see whether there may have been more terrorism kinds of words that were said approaching 9/11. And the way you do it then is to match not the exact words, because what you really want is a concept match. So I wrote a program that would match the words that people entered for each trial against these words: airplane falling, explode, fire, attack, terror, disaster, Pentagon, and smoke.
Thank God for computers.
Yeah. So it is doing a massive crunching on every word entered, matching against these concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can create on a daily basis the degree to which the impressions that people have matched a terrorism idea. And when you do that, what you find is the same thing that we found in the card test. There is a massive drop in terrorism ideation just before 9/11, and in fact is the lowest on 9/11 itself.
Huh.
So it's the same kind of repression effect. So it was opposite to what I originally thought, that these were not words that were intruding into people's minds. They were perhaps feeling premonitions coming up, but they specifically avoided these kinds of words.
Repress them. A natural human reaction to something too overwhelmingly disastrous to even...
Right.
Yeah, even if you didn't consciously know to the World Trade Center buildings were going down. If you didn't know that consciously, it didn't matter. You had this impending feeling of something really big and not so good, and so your brain automatically locked it out so you could take care of business.
Right. It filtered out the relevant information.
Well, that's fascinating.
So if you look at these two tests now, the CART test and this remote viewing test, the combined odds against chance of seeing such a large drop so close to 9/11 are odds of 1.8 million to 1. So it really does suggest that people's behavior collectively really did change before that event. And there are other dips and valleys, you know, throughout the database, but nothing as deep as these two points.
Well, a question for you. I was going to ask you if you had run into any apparent savants in this area, and the answer is you obviously have. Now, have you ever considered attempting to contact these individuals and perhaps work with them?
I'm planning on doing that for the remote viewing test. So far, I've just done it for the CART test. We ran two formal talent tests for people who appear to be good at the talent test.
How's it going?
The results were not so good. The first round was okay. It was interesting. And the second round, in which we picked out the people who appeared to do very well, seemed to be have performance anxiety. And so their performance was basically right at chance.
Huh.
So using this as a means of selecting talent, at least for the CART test, did not work very well. And so now we'll try it again on the remote viewing test.
When they were home in front of the monitor, relaxed, it just slowed. That's interesting. I believe I described to you the one. I've only had one incident in my whole life of precognition, and I didn't solicit it. Mm-hmm. I didn't want it, wasn't thinking about it, and it forced itself on me like with the strength of incoming ocean waves. I could no more resist it than the man in the moon. But it's never happened again. I can't bring it on at will. I'm not sure I'd want it to happen again.
Right.
But that's how it happened. It was powerful. It was undeniable. But it was a single event in my life.
Right. So you can imagine if you describe that event and people get all excited about it and they say, do it again.
No.
Well, so that seems to be what happens here, that we find people who occasionally are just incredibly good, but they don't really know how they did it. You know, they spontaneously did it somehow. And then when they're asked to try to do it again...
They can't.
They can't.
Or they have performance anxiety, as
right.
you mentioned.
Right.
So is that true across the board in PSI? Across the world, we hear of these people with these incredible talents.
Mm-hmm.
And are there some of them that absolutely on demand can perform? I know there are yogis who can control their heartbeat and other aspects of their physiology, right?
Right. Yes, some people can do it on demand. Nobody's 100%, but some people are above chance often enough and can do it on demand often enough that they have real talent. And also, the CART tests are probably the worst kind of test to do this for.
Why?
Because they're intensely boring. They're enormous fun for about 5 minutes, and then you'd rather stick something in your ear. It just becomes boring. It's mentally exhausting to do this over and over again. So it takes a very rare person who has the discipline to be able to train themselves to be able to do this. Now, I've heard tales of people who have trained themselves to do this very, very well, but I haven't seen it yet. I'm planning on visiting someone who claims to have done this.
Oh?
Who claim to train themselves to be able to tell what playing cards were, hidden playing cards. So I'm going to test it.
I'm glad that you're able to do that. My feeling would be that if there were quite a number of individuals out there with a tremendous amount of talent, that they might, after reflection, not really want it known. I mean, it could bring many problems.
Well, there's a difference between demonstrating an ability for purposes of science, where the person is not identified, and something quite different where someone wants to now go on the Tonight Show and make a big splash.
So that's the appeal you would make to them.
This
is science, and you would indeed keep their confidentiality very carefully.
I would insist on it. Yeah, it would be a condition of the test. Because, I mean, I'm not in the business, nor do I have any interest in promoting somebody's performance career. So that would be part of the test.
Okay. I've got a whole lot of people who would like to ask you questions. So let's dip in and see what we get. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dean Radin. Good morning. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hi, I am calling from Seattle. My name is Vivian.
Yes, Vivi.
And I've been listening to you for years. Me and my mom and dad actually drove down to see you in Portland, but there were so many people who couldn't get in line.
Okay.
And I wanted to call, and all this talk is making me think about my dreams. I had the same exact dream as my boyfriend at the same exact time, and we woke up at the same exact time. Looking at each other directly in the eye. Knowing that we just dreamt the same exact thing, hearing my voice in each other's head when we woke up. Mm-hmm. And I don't sing, but I've always wanted to. And that made me think of it. Global
okay,
consciousness.
I don't know if it's the same thing. I don't know if it's global consciousness, but it is, I guess it might be part of that love study you talked about.
Yeah, I would call that entangled minds.
Entangled minds.
Right. It's of all spontaneous psychic events, half of them occur in the dream state. Hmm. So this is a good example of a telepathic connection in the dream state.
Not that uncommon?
No, not very uncommon at all. I mean, if half of all reported spontaneous effects occur in the dream state, and there are tens of thousands of such cases, this is probably more common than people know.
Fascinating. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Entangled dream states, and why not? Wildcard line, you're on the air with Dean Radin. Hi.
Good morning, Art. This is Stephen in Columbus, Georgia.
Yes, sir.
It's amazing, Dean, that you guys can't check animals for this kind of thing.
Hard enough to check humans.
I understand that.
Even humans don't have the words.
I know, but I had a thing happen to me 18th of May. My dog has been, of course, sick. And she went outside to lay in the veranda, lay in the backyard for a while. And when I went outside to look for her, I couldn't find her.
Mm-hmm.
And found her laying next to her brother's grave.
Mm-hmm.
So I got her up, and of course she was close to 12 years old. I brought her back inside, was about to stir up some chicken breast for her. And she looked at me and she died. Just right there. She laid her head down and died. Right
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
She knew that she was about to die. I'm firmly convinced of that. There's no other explanation for it but that.
Well, I believe it. I absolutely believe it. And, Dean, that's also something you would think that the human mind or a dog mind, any mind, would repress, would, you know, our mortality is probably our biggest fear of all, isn't it?
But, you know, there is interesting research now coming out of people who work in hospices where someone who's near death may be in a coma for a long time, and then just before they die, they become lucid, almost as though they really do know that death is approaching.
Perfect clarity, yes.
Yeah, so that is more common than we think also.
Oh, no, that's very common. Mm-hmm. I have a number of friends in doctors and so forth, and they have told me exactly that mm-hmm. there is this moment in so many of nearly absolute clarity near death,
right.
And apparently an awareness of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess some choose not to blank that out, and maybe that was a case of that. I don't know.
It sounds like it, yeah.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dean Radin. Hi.
Hi, Art and Dean. This is Jonathan in New Orleans. And my question, Dean, is Did you examine a subset of the eggs in the vicinity of the tsunami for interesting activity? And also, I was wondering if your website explains how the random numbers are generated, and if not, can you explain that?
Okay.
We don't have too many random generators in the area of Asia where the tsunami hit. So the answer is no. We haven't partitioned out those generators yet.
Okay.
To look at them.
All right.
There is a technical description of the random generators on the website.
Is there sort of a down and dirty way to describe it?
Well, they're essentially electronic coin flippers.
That's good. Electronic coin flippers.
Yeah. The source of randomness in each case is traceable down to a quantum event. So the coin is being flipped, and depending on whether it lands heads or tails is dependent on an electron tunneling through a diode, basically. So it's a truly random event.
And you've documented, didn't you say 186 events?
186 formal events and 199 total events.
Uh-huh. And that currently, the chance of it being an accident?
50,000 to 1.
50,000 to 1. And that number has been much higher.
Yeah, it has fluctuated.
And just the fact that that number fluctuates that much also is unto itself a study, I suppose, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Dean, those are a couple of interesting words, absolute proof. Where do the numbers have to go with the work you're doing for that gong to ring, and even the most cynical of scientists out there to say, throw up their hands and say, the numbers are too big? It's true.
Well, the numbers alone won't do it. I mean, the total odds against chance for some of these classes of experiments, as I said, for telepathy, 29 quintillion to 1. And it goes way beyond that, too. There are other criticisms that you can address and show that the data withstands the criticisms. But that's not enough. When we're dealing with a controversial topic, you need a theory which makes sense to people.
An explanation?
Some sort of explanation. And if you get really controversial, and of course this is, oftentimes people will have to do experiments themselves to convince themselves that these effects really are true. Fortunately, these phenomena are very common. If you ask any average audience whether there are scientists in it or not, you always get between 50 and 70% of people admitting to at least one form of psychic phenomena. That means that these kinds of things go on all the time. And the reason why scientists are interested in this is not necessarily because they look at the scientific articles, but because they have an experience. And they become curious like everyone else and trying to figure out how does that work.
It's true.
Yeah. That's
sure.
How I got involved in this.
You had your own experience.
No, actually. I came from a purely scientific perspective. I was reading the articles and saying, this is nonsense. This doesn't match anything that I've ever been taught. But if it's true, it would be really amazing.
Uh-huh.
So I started doing experiments. And so people ask me, what are my amazing psychic experiences? And the answer is, the experiments that I did. Not the personal things that happened to me, but the experiments that I did because they were controlled. And if you get an interesting result under controlled conditions, at least for me, that is much more powerful than something which happens spontaneously.
Oh, but you'd be surprised. You just wait till it happens.
Life... Oh, no, I'm not saying I haven't had amazing things happen. I'm just saying that from a rational perspective, it's something that's very solid when you control the circumstances.
That's true.
If it's not controlled, it may have a powerful emotional effect on me, but unfortunately, I'm also trained as a psychologist, and I understand there are lots of ways that we fool each other and fool ourselves.
Well, it's true, but all of this is being nailed down scientifically, using scientific methods all
right.
The way.
Yep.
Okay. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dean Radin. Hi.
Yeah, hi. This is John from Los Angeles.
Yes, sir.
I have a question. I want to make sure I have this straight first.
Sure.
the eggs, this is an experiment to find a relationship between the realm of consciousness and events that take place. Is that correct?
I'd say it's fair, isn't it, Dean?
Between consciousness and matter.
Oh, matter.
Yeah. I mean, it's a mind-matter interaction experiment.
Okay,
on a large scale.
What is the exact relationship between the number generators and the matter, or the consciousness, the realm of consciousness?
Well, the hypothesis is that if mind and matter are related in some way,
right,
that when one side of that equation, namely the mind side, becomes very coherent,
mm-hmm.
or because of all of the attention paid on a world event, that the other side of the equation, namely the matter, would also become coherent. What does coherence mean in matter? It means order, some form of unexpected order. And so we use random number generators because the only unexpected thing that can happen to a random system is to become ordered. And we know how to detect that order.
And so if it begins to become ordered, the alarms go off, as it were.
Yes.
So are we saying that these generators are in of themselves conscious?
Maybe not that they're conscious.
On the matter side?
They are reflecting.
Reflecting it.
They're reflecting a change in the mind side of the equation.
Oh, I see.
That a help?
Yeah, and I just wanted to make a comment, actually. If we can measure consciousness, if it is a very radiant energy source, perhaps we could use that to map the universe as far as, you know, finding beacons of life and consciousness on other planets, right?
Oh, it, you know, that's a leap, but I mean...
No, I think it's, yes, I would agree.
I was going to say, why not? Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dean Radin. Hello.
How are you guys this evening?
Just fine, sir.
Mm-hmm. I've got something I want to run by you. This is Jamie from Greenville, Texas.
Yes, sir.
Let's say that our brain and our conscience is like a Las Vegas odds maker. And it absorbs every news story, every newspaper article, every opinion, just everything that we come into contact with from the time that we're kids. And it constantly just generates odds of, you know, such as like a terrorist attack, tensions building, you know, stuff that we overlook every day, but our brain is clicking out the odds from what we observe. And as it draws near and the odds of something happening becoming greater, that our brain sends us signals saying, hey, you know, wake up, this is about to happen.
Well, I think that's exactly what you're looking at, isn't it, Dean?
Yeah, and it's probably true for ordinary events and ordinary perception as well. The brain is always calculating probabilities of things. And we become aware of it when the probabilities get real high.
So you're nowhere close to being able to prove to the scientific community that it's just absolutely true. But it would seem to me that a reasonable person reading the results that you have so far almost could not avoid getting involved.
I would say that for a neutral person, an open-minded person who goes through the technical papers, they will become interested. They may not be convinced because, I mean, it's difficult to be convinced about such things, but they would become interested. And in many ways, that's really all you can ask from a scientific perspective. You hope that the interest is high enough so that they want to go ahead and start doing experiments on their own. And that is beginning to happen.
I was going to ask. You are beginning to see that now.
Yes.
Uh-huh. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dean Radin. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to bring up, let me be devil's advocate here.
Sure.
What if there's a sinister side to this, that it may be like a black ops project with massive mind control, and you're calling in on these, you're dialing up into a computer net and giving them the results they want to know?
Through
subliminal messages,
yes, uh-huh.
Satellite frequencies or whatever.
Could there be a negative side to this? The clear answer to that has to be, I think, yes. This is just a field or a force or a natural fact. And so if it can be manipulated, then it can be manipulated probably as any other force, good or bad. Dean?
Yeah, I think part of the idea of the sinister side of all of this stuff comes about because of our natural fear of the unknown. I don't really think, I mean, I know that in principle, people could use these abilities either in a positive or negative way, but as we said before, positive and negative are relative.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not clear to me that it's so easy to always know. The fear element of it is always there. I mean, it's true that within the government there are folks who would face the giggle factor, but there's also a fear factor.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just part of the unknown. It's not just this area, it's any area where there are things that are unknown.
How critically important to the success of these kind of experiments is intent? How big a part is intent?
Factors like intention, novelty, motivation are all extremely important. It probably the most important factors are motivation and intent.
Hmm. Worrisome. The people who wish us dead have extreme motivation, extremely strong intent, just enormously so, to the very core of their being. And I hope we're as passionate about our freedom as they are about removing it.
So do I.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dean Radin. Hi. Hello.
Hi. I want to thank Dean for Gatsai. I've been, visiting the site over the last year. Recently, I haven't had much of a chance to do it, but I've been using it to boost my psychic abilities and remote view Sasquatch up here in the Pacific Northwest. And my kids have seen it a few times. And having, increased my psychic ability, I've won, little bits here and there on Lotto and things like that. Anyway, but...
All right, well, let's turn that into this. Dean, is it possible to use, for example, those games and increase your psychic ability? Can you sit there hour after hour and day after day, if you so chose, and use those tests to increase your ability? That's a pretty good question, actually.
Yes, I believe you can.
You can?
Yeah. It's not anything magical about the test, of course. It's more that any time you use discipline in training yourself to do something with your mind, you're going to get better at it.
Oh.
So I can accept that people can use these games, since they're very simple and compelling, to train themselves to become more and more intuitively attuned. So yes, that could happen.
That's really interesting. And she noted that she had done so, though not for a while now. But just putting yourself in that receptive mode, after a while, I suppose, it's like any other training.
Exactly.
Your mind learns how to do it.
Yeah, it takes the discipline and practice. How do you get to Carnegie Hall?
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dean Radin. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Art. How are you?
Oh, just great.
The question I have, I've had premonitions, precognitions, off and on for years, and it seems like the strongest ones I have concern death. I don't know why that is. I was wondering if Dean maybe had any insight into that as far as his research with death being such a strong factor.
Okay, sure. I mean, death, after all, our mortality is, again, perhaps, probably our biggest fear, so... Dean?
Issues of life and death are the number one topic or number one subject for any kind of psychic experience, whether it's a premonition or telepathy or anything else. So it's not too surprising because the importance and the motivational factors are very, very extreme. So that's probably why.
Dean, have you ever... Since we last talked, I ran into the work of this man, George Meeks.
Mm-hmm.
You know about that? and something called Spiricom.
Yes.
I've run into a lot of things in my career doing what I do and looking into these kinds of things here, and it's a little painful to listen to all the Spiricom tapes, but I've done it, and I'm telling you, I had hair standing up on the back of my neck all the way through that. It's some of the most remarkable, amazing work, and I do think it's that. I don't think it was any kind of a hoax or anything. It was just astounding what Meeks did, and I wonder how you feel about that.
That's a tricky one. Oftentimes in the EVP world, electronic voice phenomena world,
yes,
the assumption is that there's something about the machinery itself which is doing it. But I think even the people will admit after a while that the operator, the human element, is equally important, maybe more important.
I wouldn't argue with that.
In which case, it raises the possibility that the sounds that are recorded may not be from spirits, but may be from the human operator. In fact, this is an issue that comes up in mediumship research all the time. Where does the source of information or the source of the influence come from? My guess is that it either all the time or almost all the time comes from the human operator.
Entirely possible, of course.
Or from the medium.
Yeah, of course, it's possible.
Yeah, but of course, people who wish to look for evidence for survival put that lower on their list of possibilities because they would rather believe that it's coming from some kind of spirit.
Mm-hmm. Are you disinclined to believe that there is a form of consciousness or something that survives?
I would say probably like a lot of people, I would like that to be true, but I haven't been convinced by the evidence yet. And I've paid pretty close attention to a broad range of evidence. And the reason why I'm skeptical is because we know a lot about psi in the living. And we don't yet know the limits of psi in the living.
That's true.
And by comparison, we don't know anything about psi in the dead. I mean, not directly. So it's simply when you use Occam's razor on the evidence to try to decide what are you going to believe, my guess is, my sense of the evidence is that we're dealing with things having to do with living people and not departed people. I wish that's not true, and I'm ready to believe it, but that there's some form of consciousness that survives, but I haven't been convinced yet.
So it's not necessarily a natural extension of the work you're doing, which seems mystical and incredible enough to take that other jump to the other side and imagine that somehow survives in all that is so holistic.
No, I can easily imagine that what we call consciousness in terms of human awareness really is tied in some very significant way to the brain.
Huh.
And the psychic ability then does not necessarily mean that your mind and your brain are not the same thing, or not connected in some way.
Well, what you're doing is thoroughly exciting enough. And again, your book, The Conscious Universe, is available. And if people want to know more, and I can't imagine how they wouldn't, they should go out and grab your book right away. My friend, thank you.
You're welcome.
It has been an absolute pleasure having you on. Good night, Dean.
Good night.
We're out of time, folks. That's all there is. And what we have talked about tonight, I think, saying it again, is one of the most important things that we have ever discussed on this show, and I'm sure that years to come will prove me absolutely right.